Welcome to In the Studio, the 21st Century Perspective on the biggest rock albums in history.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
I'm Redbeard, and today David Gilmour, Nick Mason, and Roger Waters return in the studio for the conclusion of Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Open your heart. I'm coming home.
And I refused to do it outdoors. Larry Magid, bless him, the main promoter in Philadelphia, said, please, please come and do it. He'd seen the show in LA, and then he said, please, please come and do it in JFK Stadium in Philadelphia, outdoors. He said, I will guarantee you a clear $1 million a night to do it. But how can you do a show that's about the alienation that you feel about doing stadium shows in a stadium? This is Roger Waters in the studio for The Wall.
In the studio with Redbeard, this is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard. Part 2.
The members of Pink Floyd were never very comfortable with stardom. They were, for the most part, a band without a face. Even as they were selling millions of albums and selling out huge stadiums, many of their fans would have been hard-pressed to recognize a single member on the street. Some knew that David Gilmour was the guitarist, that Roger Waters played bass, and that the two of them wrote most of the songs. But a lot of Pink Floyd fans couldn't tell one member of the band from the other. But as much as the members of Pink Floyd resisted it, a certain amount of celebrity was unavoidable. I mean, there's no way to play concerts in front of 50,000 people and hope to remain truly anonymous. No way to avoid being mobbed, being followed, being worshipped. It was that last part, the idolatry of it all, that bothered Roger Waters the most. He saw a dark side to the spotlight, and it frightened him, frankly. The sheer size, the unreality of it all seemed dangerous to Waters. Those were the emotions that led him to write The Wall. It was an album about alienation, about distance, about losing touch. But more than that, it was an album about reaching out. Don't forget, Roger Waters built The Wall so that he could finally tear it down.
When I go to the movies or listen to records or whatever, just occasionally I see something that moves me to the extent that I feel, well, yeah, I understand that. I can understand this man or this woman. I feel like that too a bit. I get a good feeling knowing that there's somebody else out there who feels the same way. Well, we're getting into the songs of The Wall now. You know, does anybody else out there feel the way I do? That's all it's about, really. You know, firing my arrows into the void with the hope that somebody will catch one of them and go, yeah, I recognize this feeling. And it gives you, you know, it, well, for me anyway, when I go and see a really good movie that expresses some feeling that I have or something, it gives me heart to carry on, you know, and it gives me strength to go on trying to be human.
Hey you, out there in the cold, getting lonely, getting old, can you feel me? Hey you, standing in the aisles with itchy feet and fading smiles, can you feel me? Hey you, don't help them to bury the light. Don't give in without a fight. Stone. your heart, I'm coming home.
When Rolling Stone magazine published a list of the greatest live performances in rock history, high on that list was a tour from the year 1980, a series of shows that Rolling Stone magazine said, and I quote, took the theatrical potential of live rock to its most vivid extreme, end quote. That tour they were talking about was Pink Floyd's The Wall. It was a show so complex and so expensive to produce that it was only performed 32 times. It was a spectacle beyond anything rock and roll audiences had ever seen. It was an assault of light and sound and special effects that no one had dared to even try before. There were crashing planes, electronic creatures, and of course, the wall itself, 35 feet high, 200 feet wide. It was constructed on stage as the audience watched, slowly growing brick by cardboard brick. And when it was finished, Pink Floyd was out of sight, separated from its audience by the wall.
So much happened in the show that it would take an enormous amount of time to explain it all. I mean, the audience come in and there's about 40% of the wall across the arena. So it's a jagged kind of line, a bit like the inside of the album sleeve. An announcer came on and made a speech in a dinner jacket. He was actually an actor, but I wanted to make a point during the show, so I had this guy come on and say, please don't block the freeways and don't do this and don't do that and don't do and all those kind of things that people say in shows. But that was actually a device for something that happened later on. And then the band appeared, but in all the black stuff, and it was actually the surrogate band on a stage out front, and they were all wearing masks, so they looked like us, but they weren't us. They were four other guys, and they played the beginning of In the Flesh. A drape went up behind the wall, and there we were, and then a plane came in from the back, you know, a model kind of Stuka, about 15-20 feet wingspan, and went over a bit of the wall, and a kind of explosion happens, and then the baby cries, and then we go into the thin ice, and then the band are revealed on the back while this band at the front, so the audience realizes that the people that they applauded starting are not actually Pink Floyd, they're somebody else. And and it went on like that for until the end of the first half.
Seven-disc box set, there are some amazing song demos, plus live performances from Pink Floyd's The Wall 1980-81 tour that are previously unreleased, such as What Shall We Do Now? Just reminiscing with me about those limited performances was enough to excite The Wall composer, Roger Waters, into plans to performing it again.
And the second half was really about breaking through the wall. But there was a hotel room built into it that flapped down. Oh, it went on and on and on. It was, I have to say, it was absolutely wonderful. And I may say also that I'm toying with the idea of doing it again, because one of the things that I got out of my acrimonious departure from my ex-colleagues was all the rights to all of that. It was the only thing I ever really insisted on, was that I got the wall. So I might even do it again.
Great news on that later. Pink Floyd singer-guitarist David Gilmour and drummer Nick Mason explained what limited The Wall 80-81 tour to barely 30 shows.
It was about a week each in
Los Angeles first.
LA, New York, London, then Dortmund in Germany, then another week in London the following year. So it was amounted to somewhere between 30 and 35 shows, I should think, something like that. Total, not that many. Certainly not enough to cover the mega costs of putting it on. Very, very difficult to move it around. Very reluctant to go on doing it too many times. It was a mega achievement for us to do it, and it was great fun to do, but it was also slightly restrictive as a show, I think. And by the end of it, it was rather like clockwork. We could all do it and do it very well, but it was not terribly challenging by the end, and there were very few points in it where one could break out and have a little play or a little jam or do something slightly different. It was so regimented that it started getting...
It was more like performing a West End show, really, than playing music.
Yeah, Broadway theatrical-type production, yeah.
Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Is there
Roger Waters confirms that the Wall tour just didn't add up.
It really was unbelievably expensive to put on. The reason that we did so few shows was because indoors, it was really too expensive to countenance. We lost about 600 grand, I think, doing the shows. And so you couldn't really make a case for going on doing it. Because I think what the world was getting out of it was not worth the expense of putting it on. And I refused to do it outdoors. Larry Magid, bless him, the main promoter in Philadelphia, said, please, please come and do it. He'd seen the show in LA, and then he said, please, please come and do it in JFK Stadium in Philadelphia, outdoors. He said, I will guarantee you a clear $1 million a night to do it. But how can you do a show that's about the alienation that you feel about doing stadium shows in a stadium?
I asked Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason to give us a thumbnail sketch of the late Michael Kamen, the orchestrator and arranger on The Wall.
Michael Kamen, brought in by Bob Ezrin, a friend of Bob's, to do the string arrangements for The Wall. And a wonderfully sort of easygoing guy, really easy to work with, enthusiastic, and a lovely man. I mean, we ended up, whenever there were strings required, Michael would do them. And one Michael story is, where I think we wanted strings for Momentary Love, on Division Bell, I think. And Michael agreed that he would do the string parts, but in return, we wouldn't pay him, but we would equip a kids, it was a kids theatre or a kids musical group, and we would provide equipment for them.
How cool is that?
Well, that's quite cool. Very nice man, sorely missed. Brilliant. And a great talent, of course. I mean, you know, he was involved in a lot of great soundtracks and film scores.
David Gilmour contends that the sheer scope of The Wall required not only the outside producer Bob Ezrin, but also all hands on deck.
We were all directing, but Bob was another intelligent, discerning person who certainly had some very good input onto the way, and had a lot of strength as well to say, you know, this piece just isn't good enough, you know, this song isn't strong enough, and let's think again, start again, you know, which happened many, many times, you know. And you get Roger going off home in a huff because we'd said we didn't like something, and he'd shoot off home, and he'd, like, 2 days later, he'd come back in with something much better, which, in his sort of rage and anger at having something turned down, he'd say, well, I'll show you, motherfucker. He'd come back in with something far better. Nobody Home was like that. I remember he went off angry about something, and the next day time he came in with Nobody Home, which is fantastic.
Got a little black book with my poems in. Got a bag, got a toothbrush and a comb in. When I'm a good dog, they sometimes throw me a bone. Plastic bands keeping my shoes on. Got those swollen hand blues. I got 13 channels of shit on the TV to choose from. I got electric light. I got second sight. I got amazing powers of observation. That is how I know. When I try to get through on the telephone to you, there'll be nobody home. Up my mortal remains.
strong urge to fly, but I got nowhere to fly to.
Fly to, fly to.
Nobody Home features vocal by Roger Waters, who returns with Nick Mason and David Gilmour to describe how The Wall became a major motion picture. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear lots more rock candy at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for Pink Floyd's The Wall.
In the Studio with Redbeard. This is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
This is Roger Waters in the studio for The Wall.
Part 2.
Thank you all. When it came time to tour in 1980, the complexities of The Wall were magnified and multiplied, testing the limits of live portable production then in a pre-digital world. Doing The Wall live was risking a myriad of things going wrong, and according to Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason, sometimes they did.
To some extent, in the old days, things did go wrong. And I still remember, what was the place in, I think it's Detroit.
Cobo Hall? Cobo Hall.
Cobo Hall, yes. Yeah, that's right. We had a fantastic night there where one of the fireworks, it was a sort of fire pot that went off at some particular stage of the proceedings, and there was a stage weight holding the thing down, and when the stage weight was superheated by the explosion, it exploded, and with the most almighty bang, which not only I think one person in the front got a bit of shrapnel.
They survived
and were back for the second half, but what it did do was it blew out every single speaker that we had on stage, so that from then on, the whole thing sounded as though we were playing underwater.
You had no monitors.
Well, we had monitors because the thing would still buzz and hum and sort of give a sort of distorted view of what was going on.
Working monitors.
And we certainly weren't prepared to stop then.
Wow.
And I have to say, a great tribute to both us as performers and the audience for living through a war zone. But we did manage to finish.
Hello, hello, hello. Is there anybody in there? Just not if you can hear me. Is there anyone at home? Come on, come on, clack. I hear you feeling down. Well, I can ease the pain. You on your feet again. Relax, relax. I need some information first. Just the basic facts. Now can you show me where it hurts? There is no pain, you are receding. A distant ship's low on the horizon. You are only coming through in waves. Your lips move, but I can't hear what you're saying.
there'll be no more. But you may feel a little sick. Now can you stand up?
Stand up, stand up, stand up.
I do believe it's working. Good. That'll keep you going through the show. Come on, it's time to go.
There is no pain, you are receding. A distant ship smoke on the horizon. You are only coming through in waves. Your lips move, but I can't hear what you say.
Included in the Wall box set, Pink Floyd live on the Wall Tour 1980 with David Gilmour having a play, as he put it, on Comfortably Numb. Roger Waters certainly conceived the Wall cinematically, and to no one's surprise, a theatrical film of it was released in 1982, directed by Midnight Express and Fame director Alan Parker. Here's Roger Waters.
I always thought that it might make a movie. Alan Parker expressed a great interest in it, and we talked and talked, and I started writing odd bits of screenplay, and I don't know, it just slowly happened. to start with, it was going to be a kind of combination of show film, you know, of rock and roll concert film with illustrations of what the concert was about. And it stopped being that quite quickly and turned into what it eventually became.
Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason with me in the studio. Remind us of your history with Live Aid organizer Bob Geldof.
The most significant piece of history with Bob was that he was chosen to play the part of Pink in the film version of The Wall. And I think he did a great job. I mean, I thought he was terrific. And there are all sorts of wonderful bits and pieces of stuff. It took a long time to actually get Bob to come and audition, because Alan Parker was auditioning a lot of quite well-known actors at the time for this thing. But having said that, they absolutely made the right choice, I think, in choosing Bob to play the part. I think the film still stands up now really pretty well.
Roger Waters tells how Pink Floyd landed Boomtown Rats lead singer Bob Geldof for the Wall movie lead.
Alan suggested him, and I said, yeah, good idea, great idea, see if he's interested. And so he called him up, and he wasn't interested, but he decided to do it anyway. In fact, there's a very funny story. He was asked to do it, and he was going to do some gigs on the continent. And he went with Faulkner O'Kelly, who was his manager at the time, I don't know, maybe he still is, to the airport. And he was going, I've been asked to do this Pink Floyd bloody Wall thing. What a load of crap and raw bloody rubbish. They send me this, I can't. And Faulkner was trying to persuade him that it would be a good career move and da-da-da and bloody-bloody-blah and da-da-da-da. And none of this would ever have come to light, except that my brother was the cab driver. I laid this on Geldof later at the time. He could not believe it, quite rightly, because what an incredible coincidence. It was my brother John. Anyway, at least Bob and I never had any kind of, you know, there was never any pussyfooting about what he thought about Pink Floyd and the music and so on and so forth, because he was extremely scathing about the whole thing. And I never tried to persuade him differently. You know, these bog Irish, you can't tell them anything. They wouldn't understand. There's no point in me I'm not going to waste my education on Geldof trying to explain the Wall to him. He understands. He just doesn't realise he understands. Because he does understand. He does understand. And if there's one man in the world who understands, it's got to be Geldof. Bless him.
David Gilmour with me in the studio.
The arguments and fights that myself and Roger had during the latter half of making the album were pretty intense on certain things. We had some real major scraps on certain things, and that left our relationship a bit more damaged at the end of that album. And again, in the film, there were one or two things that happened during the film that I felt that I absolutely had to do, that I know Roger's never forgiven me for. Basically, on outvoting him and telling him that he had to stay in line on certain things, which are very sort of hard to explain, but when you've got millions of dollars invested in a project, there are certain protections that you have to stick to, that I felt I had to stick to. And so I was the only one around who could actually take on the role of overruling him and telling him that there were certain things that he couldn't do. And I think that period our relationship probably became irreparably damaged and remained that way through the final cut album, which was torture.
Are there any paranoids in the audience tonight? Is there anyone who worries about things? Pathetic. This is for all the weak people in the audience. Is there anyone here who's weak? This is for you. It's called Run Like Hell. Let's all have a clap!
We'll be right back.
Roger Waters in the studio.
Let's be honest about this. By the time we were doing The Wall, the band really didn't exist. But by the time we got into The Wall, really it was my band. It was my work, and we did what I said, and the others did as they were told, and that was all there was to it. If your perception was that here was the ultimate band, and and we were all sort of jolly and happy and cooperating, it wasn't like that. I'm not saying I did it all, because I didn't. Obviously, Dave Gilmour's contribution to the making of The Wall was huge. He's a marvellous guitarist, and he contributed to, a number of songs in terms of their construction and so on and so forth. But we were not a together unit. But the band was really difficult then. And the live shows of The Wall were the swan song. That was it. That was all that we could possibly achieve. It was over.
Ah, but life has an uncanny way of making you behave, as you shall hear next as we conclude our peek behind the wall. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Roger Waters, Nick Mason, and David Gilmour for Pink Floyd's The Wall, Part 2.
In the studio with Redbeard, this is David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Nick Mason of Pink Floyd with Redbeard.
This is Roger Waters in the studio for The Wall.
Part 2.
An honor, gentlemen. When in 2003, David Gilmour donated an eye-popping $7.5 million from the sale of a London house and gave the proceeds to a homeless charity, I found that his and Pink Floyd's commitment to philanthropy was by no means recent.
It goes back a long, long way before that. And pretty well all the English shows, the shows that we did in Britain going back into the 70s, went towards charities of one sort or another. It's been a bit of a tradition of ours. We used to pay so much tax on the shows in England that it didn't seem much point in hanging on to it when you could have it do some good and not pay tax on it. But I still support that charity amongst a number of others. Amnesty International, loads of them. I mean, there's worldwide ones that are involved with political refugees, with torture and stuff in the whole world, and there are local ones to do with tiny projects in small towns in the UK. Well, I'm very, very fortunate. I've done very well for myself, and I feel I should give something back, so I have been putting something into my charitable foundation every year. It only seems like the fair and reasonable thing to do. A friend of mine called Bella Freud has a charity for Palestinian children called Hoping, which I played at a little bit the year before. Polly thought, my wife thought, that it would be great if we could get Roger on and get him to sing To Know Him Is to Love Him with me on that show, that old song by the Teddy Bears. We thought it would be quite ironic to sing that together. And I asked Roger if he would do that with us. He had already agreed to doing something on this Hoping show, but he wanted to stick to Pink Floyd stuff. And I said, come on, do this one. And he told me that it was outside of his comfort zone. And so I said to him, well, how about if I promise to come and play The Wall, play Comfortably Numb on one of your Wall shows, will you do it then? He said, sure. So he moved right out of his comfort zone, and he came to this Hoping show, and we did that, and it was terrific, really good fun. And that's easily viewable somewhere online, I guess. And so I made a promise, and of course you have to honour your promises, and I went along to the O2, got up on top of that wall and did my thing, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a really exciting moment for me. The audience seemed to like it too.
Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason was there that night as well. A penny for your thoughts about performing with Dave Gilmour recently on stage when Roger performed The Wall at the O2 Arena.
Mm-hmm. Great fun and very moving again. It was a sort of micro Live 8 moment because, of course, it wasn't broadcast to a billion people or whatever. And it was just a one-off sort of golden moment. I was just really pleased to be there, and I found it much more emotional than I expected. And it was just really nice because it was, the plan was, and the plan had sort of been whether David would play or not had not been absolutely agreed. But it had been talked about for a while, but what had been talked about was just the idea of David playing. That was it. But what was great was actually being there and then, you know, Roger saying, oh, come on, you know, you better come on as well at the end. Which had not been my intention. I just wanted to be there to see it. And it was actually really nice to be back, just sort of climb up and bang the tambourine and be part of that, play that last number with them and sort of be there rather than actually on the floor watching it.
And the following day, YouTube was abuzz with amateur handheld video by fans in the audience of Roger Waters performing Comfortably Numb while David Gilmour perched precariously high atop the wall. The visual effect was both stunning and a bit frightful. Here's David.
There's a lift system that goes along the stage behind the wall so that the guys who build the wall can build the wall. And they have to go up on those hoists that go up. And each one is sort of, I guess, 15 feet long by about 4 feet wide. And they're on hydraulic poles that hoist them up to the top. And so I commandeered one of those, and we put my guitar amps and some monitors and a mic stand and a little bit of railing around the front and the back, and me on there, pressed the button, and off I went up to the top. You know, I'm not too scared of heights. I don't know, 25 feet, 30 feet. When you're 30 feet up, it looks an awful long way down, and this looked an awful long way down. Maybe 40 feet, something in that area. No, it's not. It's not really risky. It's better if it looks risky. But that's showbiz for you.
Waiting to smash in the windows and kick in the doors. Waiting.